Hello, I'm Claire Wright, Professor of Public Engagement at La Trobe University. Welcome to Literary La Trobe, a podcast showcasing the writing and research of La Trobe University's staff, students, alumni, and adjuncts. The recording you're about to hear is from the 2024 Bendigo Writers Festival. I was fortunate to be the co-curator of the Bendigo Writers Festival in 2024, programming a suite of sessions under the La Trobe Presents banner. The festival took place on the second weekend of August on the unceded country of the Dja-Dja-Wurrung and Tungurung peoples of the Kulin Nation. The closing gala of the Bendigo Writers Festival was a celebration of Australia's leading writers and thinkers. In this event, you'll hear from celebrated author Kate Grenville in conversation with me, Claire Wright, and the 2024 Stella Prize winner, Professor Alexis Wright, in conversation with La Trobe's Dr. Eve Rees. I hope you enjoy. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we are meeting this evening on the lands of the Dja-Dja-Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation and pay my respects to elders past and present, as well as acknowledging people from other Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander country who may be in the audience tonight. Lest we forget that these lands were stolen and that sovereignty was never ceded, and in the context of a writers' festival, that this has always been a place for storytelling and the sharing of words and ideas. Kate, you've been a great sharer of your words and your ideas over the course of 18 books now. Bearded Ladies came out in 1984. You'll all no doubt have your favourites, and I'm not going to list them. Perhaps your favourite was Lillian's Story, or Joan Made History, or The Secret River, which is now acknowledged as an Australian classic, taught in schools for generations now. That just makes you sound really old, not that long.
I am.
Or A Room Made of Leaves, which I must admit quickly became my favourite when it came out in 2020. That is, until the publication of Restless Dolly Maunder, which is shot to the top of my personal charts. Kate, I actually truly believe this is your best book.
Oh, thank you.
Others seem to agree with me. Restless Dolly Maunder has been listed for a swag of literary awards, including the Women's Prize for Fiction. That's the UK award, which happened this year, and it's the prize that you won when it was called the Orange Prize for the idea of perfection. In 2017, Kate was awarded the Australia Council Award for Lifetime Achievement in Literature. Welcome to Bendigo, Kate.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
So we'll get to Dolly shortly, but I actually wanted to start by taking you back to that first book, Bearded Ladies.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay.
1984.
Now, 1984. Now, one of the things that's wonderful about your website is that you write your own blurbs for your books on all of them, which I think is quite unusual. Usually that comes from the publicist. So I think that because you've written your own blurb, you're actually saying what you want the book to say, how you want it to be represented in the world. And this is what you've said. These are stories about women on the edges of things, women for whom society's idea of what a woman should be doesn't work. They know themselves to be something else altogether. Their beards are invisible. They can pass in the eyes of others as conventional women, but they know that they're something less simple, but more truthful.
Hey, that's not bad.
You should be a writer. If there's a theme that runs through all your work, Kate, across those 18 books, I think it's that last line there, the paradox between what looks to be the truth of a woman's life and what lies beneath. Even The Secret River, I think, which is ostensibly about frontier conflict, places Sal Thornhill at the centre of those violent incongruities of settler colonialism. So what do you think drew you to women on the edges of things right from the get-go?
Look, I suppose the obvious answer is that I felt myself to be one of those. I was born in 1950, and any of you in the audience, and I see a few grey hairs that might indicate some of you were born around then, you would know that we grew up with a kind of carapace of femaleness that we were supposed to inhabit. And I didn't want a bar of it. I had two older brothers, so I knew what fun boys had. I inherited their toys. I did their Meccano and stuff. But as I grew up, it was quite clear Mum was a feminist before it was a word, really, but she wanted me to fit in. When I was about 13, she gave me a pair of step-ins. Who in this audience remembers step-ins? I thought you might.
Can you explain for the rest of us?
They were like a giant elastic band, really, an elastic tube that you were supposed to put around yourself to sort of squash you in. I mean, it was a modern corset, essentially. And I think it might have been at that point that I decided that I didn't want to be a woman if being a woman was all that. Mm. And luckily, I was at the point in history where you could, in fact, find a space between being, that kind of conventional woman and being a complete outcast. And I managed to find it. Writing was one of those ways.
They're called Spanx now.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, no, truly, they still make them. You can still get rubber bands that's supposed to squish you into those tiny, weeny dresses.
Oh, my goodness.
Where so there's not a little tiny extra bit of flab. That
is tragic.
They're called Spanx.
That is truly tragic.
For us,
I like
modern
the name,
women. Kate, Neil Armfield, who adapted The Secret River into a stage play, has said of your writing that Grenville's characters show us that life is a response to an infinite play of forces. I wonder if you could tell us for a moment, as a way of getting to Dolly, what you feel are the infinite play of forces in your own life. You've already suggested that you were able to push up against some of those, but what do you feel has actually shaped you historically or culturally?
Gosh, that's a very big question. Look, I think one of them, what leaps to my mind, is that I actually had a very privileged upbringing in the sense that my mother was a feminist, avant la lettre. My father was very encouraging. I grew up in a house with lots of books and a huge respect for education. So that all shaped me to feel that the life of the mind was a really important place to live, and that writing, my father actually had written a few books, so I could sort of feel that there was an important role for a certain kind of person to think about things and try to communicate them. So that was a great privilege, and I recognise that as sort of white middle class privilege. But I suppose the other thing is, I'm being a bit frivolous here, but the other thing was I was extremely short-sighted as a child, and nobody worked that out until I was about 14. Now, I think that means that I spent my youth reading. I mean, I did spend my youth reading, and that also kind of engaged me with the world not at the level of the concrete and the doing. And then I was very lucky, very, very lucky with my teachers at school. I had a teacher who I was very bored with the English curriculum. I won't name the books that we had to learn, but anyway, I used to read other books under the desk, and the English teacher caught me doing it one day. I was reading Henderson, The Rain King, and she picked the book up and started to read the page I was up to, which happened to be slightly obscene. She stopped very quickly. Anyway, she took me away later. She said, "Wait back for me, Kathy. I'll talk to you later." But what she did was she gave me a reading list. She said, if you've got to read under the desk, and I understand you're bored with these books, read these. So she gave me a reading list of great classics. So I was incredibly lucky. If I hadn't done things like write books, I would have been throwing away the advantages that the world gave me.
How was that seen in the context of your family? I can imagine your mother might have approved. What about your brothers and your father?
Approved of
the life that you chose for yourself as a writer, and you know, it sounds like being a wife was not necessarily one of the more important ambitions of your life.
No, it certainly wasn't. That was not on the horizon for a long time. I had to meet the right guy. Look, my family, I was very lucky with my family. As I say, my father, who was quite eccentric, had written a couple of books by the time I was in my 20s. He didn't mind that I changed my name by deed poll away from his. And my brothers, one of them actually wanted to be a writer. He wrote some quite good short stories himself before he decided to do something else. So I have been incredibly blessed with my family. My mother, I suppose, was the biggest influence, and I've actually written about her in a kind of prequel to this book, a biography of my mother, One Life. She was bullied by her mother, that is, Restless Dolly Maunder, she was bullied by her mother into becoming a pharmacist at a time when women generally did not have proper training to have a proper job. So Grandma gave my mother the greatest gift that a woman can give another woman, which is financial independence. And Mum never realised that that bullying actually came from a place of love and real regard for her daughter.
Did she pass on that value to you? Did your mother want you to be financially independent? And that seems to be a contradiction to becoming a writer.
Yes, she didn't. Financial independence wasn't the big thing. She kind of assumed that I would have a job and make money, which you couldn't have assumed when she was a girl. What she did tell me, though, was when I did finally get a boyfriend, I realised that I had not the faintest idea how to cook or clean or anything like that. And I said to her, Mum, why didn't you teach me that? And she said, I didn't want you to become some man's domestic slave. And I thought, what a mother. How fantastic.
Kate, Restless Dolly Maunder started its life as a three-hour Audible production called Always Greener, which is a spoken word meditation on your grandmother's life. I actually listened to that before reading Dolly Maunder. Okay, I'm not sure how I came to it. But can you tell us how about that backdrop to writing of the book? How did you come to doing a spoken word version before you actually did the written version?
Look, like just about everything in my life, it was accidental. I had done a lot of research about my grandmother in the course of writing about my mother, because my mother's life was pretty dominated by her mother. So I'd done a lot of research about Dolly, and my agent knew that, and some of it had gone into the book about my mother and some of it hadn't. My agent knew that, and my agent discovered that Audible was actually commissioning audiobooks from writers, not taking a book and, you know, sort of just putting it on audio, but actually commissioning it specifically to work as an audiobook. And it was the middle of COVID. If it hadn't been, I think I wouldn't have done it. But it seemed like the perfect COVID project. I had the research, so I didn't need to go anywhere. It was a subject that really had begun to fascinate me. And here I was being given this opportunity to do a book that was not going to be a book. I was not going to have to read reviews about it or any of that stuff. It was just going to be me speaking into a microphone and sending it out into the world. I loved doing it, and I never quite really thought that it would become a proper book.
I think that its origin story is really an essential part of what makes Dolly Maunder so wonderful. It felt to me like kind of a great long yarn told around a campfire. When I came to read Restless Dolly Maunder, I could almost kind of imagine your grandchildren looking up at you in rapt attention with the firelight flickering in their eyes, transfixed on your every word. Like that sense of orality really carries through the book.
If only my grandchildren really did listen like that.
They're on their all iPads. To me, that sense of orality, the spoken word genesis of it really comes through in the book. And because I'd like the audience to hear a taste of that wonder, I'm going to ask you to read several passages through. I'm sort of, in some ways, structured the interview around you reading passages. Okay. Because I can hear your voice so vividly in the prose. And if I can get you to start on page 8, it's probably easier if I give you my version of it, because I've got little markings for... Obviously, we planned this ahead, had a big meeting about it.
And you write about the orality, and that's why the voice of the book came so easily. It's actually just my spoken voice. Okay.
So can you see
from there to there? To
there?
Yeah. Okay. Who in this room has been to Currabubbula or knows where it is? No. Oh, yes, there's one.
One person flagging up the
there's
back.
There's usually somebody. It's a little tiny town in the far north of New South Wales. Currabubbula Public School was a solid little square of brick with a house for the schoolmaster next to it. One room, 50 children aged from 5 to 15, long wooden benches, 5 to 14 actually. A smell of feet and the dripping on lunchtime bread, and the peppery smell of too many people in not enough air. Out the front, Mr. Murray, the teacher, and Miss Thuell, the pupil teacher. At school, you could see exactly where everyone stood. At the top were Dolly's Davis cousins, whose parents hadn't married down the way her mother had. It was never spelled out, but known just the same, that no matter how many sheep Thomas Maunder could shear in a day, he'd never be as good as Mr. Davis of the Davis Hotel. Yet those cousins and Dolly had the same grandfather, Grandfather Davis, and the same grandmother, old Granny Davis, in her 80s now, but still going strong. You couldn't kill her with a stick. Dolly and her mother visited Granny Davis now and then. Dolly's face washed and the blue check pinny on. Old Granny Davis was blind, her eyes cloudy grey with red rims, but she wouldn't let anyone else pour the tea. Stuck a finger down the side of the cup so she'd know when to stop. Granny Davis's face was such a great age it seemed dark, all the wrinkles making a web of shadows. Blind or not, she always knew where the biscuits were, groped for Dolly's hand and pushed the biscuit into it. Auntie Clara lived with Granny Davis and looked after her. Dolly would see them from the playground, old Granny Davis sitting on the veranda with her knees apart under the black dress, and Auntie Clara sitting beside her looking out at the dusty street. Auntie Clara was really a cousin, not an auntie, and she wasn't that much older than Dolly, but there she was, just sitting, hour after hour. At school there were the Davis cousins and the Dalys and the Murphys and the Howletts and the ones who rode in from Pialloway, two or three together on a pony, their hair cut the same way by the same mother putting the same pudding basin on each head in turn. At the bottom of the pack were the children who came barefoot, their clothes patched till they couldn't be patched anymore. Bert Russell was one of them. Only a piece of bread, no dripping, for his lunch, and his jacket cut down from a man's, all the buttons missing, and a torn, greasy rim round the collar. Bert was nearly the same age as Dolly and got to wear Mr. Murray's special star nearly as often as she did, so his place was next to hers on the long bench. She drew a careful chalk line on the desk so his elbow wouldn't jog hers as he wrote, and she agreed with her Davis cousins that he smelled.
I think you can see and get a taste for how companionable this book is. Don't you want to just listen to Kate Grenville read forever? So Dolly was born in 1881. She was 20 years old at Federation. She lives through two world wars and a depression. And you've reconstructed this lost world of white Anglo working class Australia. First regional, rural, and then there's an urban element to it as well. Can you explain, Kate, from a methodological point of view, how you researched Dolly's life? From what scraps of fabric you stitched her story together?
Look, I was really lucky. My mother left a vast bulk of muddled kind of memoirs, and they included a lot about her own mother, because her mother had so dominated her life. So from Mum's memoirs and stories, I actually knew basically all the events of Dolly's life. So I had the sort of timeline and the event line. There are a couple of big things, a huge betrayal by her husband and her mother, which kind of shaped her life. So I knew about all that. And I knew a whole lot of, you know, Mum would have been a writer, I think, herself in another with other chances. And the family stories that she gave me often had just the little detail, like Dolly wanted to be a teacher. But her father, and when she said to her father, "Can I please train as a teacher?" he apparently slapped his hand on the table and said, "Over my dead body, any daughter of mine goes out to work." So that phrase has travelled down through the generations and was there ready for me to use. So if you read the book, you'll see that it is there. So that was a great gift that most biographers don't have. A mother who left so much detail. But then, of course, I did what everybody else has to do, the research. And it is such a pleasure, isn't it? You know that at some point you will have to start writing, but in the meantime, you can do this fabulous thing that is fun to do, but, you know, you can justify it because it has to be done. So, of course, we all go to Trove first up, And on Trove, I didn't expect to find Dolly Maunder on Trove. My grandmother was, like, in the eyes of the world, nobody. She made no impact on the world, and yet she is in Trove. There's a description of a dance at the Currabubula Memorial Hall in 1901, I think, in which a rather sort of snaky, snide journalist describes the frocks of all the beautiful young ladies at this provincial dance, including, in fact, he says, first of all, Miss Dolly Maunder, and he then describes in some detail her dress. So that gave me... The tone of the guy is quite cynical and sort of a bit scornful about these provincials. That became a scene in the book. I made that man a character. I made him up from somebody I knew long ago. So, yeah, and all the obvious things. I mean, I read history to find out where her son Frank fought in the war before he was captured by the Japanese. He fought in Timor, Sparrow Force. Ask me anything about all that. So once you start delving, there's no end to it, and it's such fun. The problem is that at a certain point you have to pick up the pen or get out the fingers and start actually writing.
So you've plied the historian's trade, and you've been very fortunate in having personal documents that your mother has written. But I'm really interested in the way that you give Dolly an inner life as well. So as an historian myself, I know that it's this interior landscape of women that's so hard to reassemble. I'd like you to read another little bit. That here. So again, pencil marking to pencil marking.
Yeah, the inner life is very hard, and that's why this is called a novel. I really don't know what my grandmother actually thought and felt, but it was either do that or leave her story either untold or so rudimentary that no one would read it. So that's why I was prepared to do that. Oh, and this is all completely, invented, this next bit. Okay. Well, it's, let's say, extrapolated from a fact. Okay, she's not yet married, and she's gone away to stay with a school friend. She's being urged to marry, the pressure is on to marry, and in fact she's engaged, but reluctantly. So she goes to this place, Dorrigo, and she meets a man called Will Shaw. Will Shaw was a friend of Minnie and Arthur's. Minnie was her old school friend, and was often over at their place. He was good-looking in a thin, dark way, a bit of a dandy by Dorrigo standards. Dorrigo is even smaller than Currabubula. He tied a kerchief round his neck, had a leather waistcoat with buttons made of farthings, wore his hair long at the back. Will was a bit arty, had a bit of a foreign feel, even though he was Dorrigo born and bred, his family timber getters out Ferndale way. There was nothing arty or foreign about the Shores. But, oh, he was a charmer, could play the piano and had a good singing voice, which it turned out Dolly did too. So he taught her a few songs and had her stand close behind him while his long fingers flickered away on the keys. Always picked her to be his partner at euchre, knocked his foot against hers under the table, and they had some kind of magic with the cards, one every time. She hadn't known you could feel so alive, so enlarged, so full of fizz. It was quite a different thing from lying in the long grass with her old friend Jim Murphy. That had been about skins that wanted to be together, about a deep, dangerous current in the blood that ran way beyond below the surface of words. Certainly Dolly fancied the way Will Shaw looked. She liked that dandified thing about him, but this was about more than wanting to touch and be touched. This was about the person he was, and even more, it was about the sort of person she became when she was with him. As she'd become livelier, cleverer, wittier with that man from the Freeman who'd described her frock, with Will Shaw she became bigger, not squeezed down into something that was too small. And she liked being that person. Which bit of my life does that come from? It certainly comes from my life, whether I can remember that particular person that made me feel that fizz. But, you know, it's... Yeah, anyway, there it is.
Okay, so that leads to where I was going to go next, and I'll wait to go there next. But the question that I had off the back of that, Kate, is Is this the novelist or the historian in you speaking in reconstructing this scene, and how comfortable you feel with the idea of investing a woman of her generation with an inner life that might be closer to your own than hers? How do you know she liked being that person? And I'm asking that specifically, and you just almost gave me a clue at the beginning of that. You said, that picked up from a particular point. And I'm wondering whether there was a point. We've talked about this in terms of your previous work, A Room Made of Leaves, where you riffed extensively on one line in Elizabeth MacArthur's letter, where you said she said she was writing to William Dawes, and she said, "I blush at my error," and you turned that into a raging love affair between Elizabeth MacArthur and William Dawes. So I'm wanting to know whether there was a little fragment of the archive that led you to believe that Dolly liked who she was when she was with that fella.
Look, I knew from Mum that Dolly had had a couple of little affairs that might have gone as far as holding hands with a couple of blokes in Currabubula, but they were Catholic. And, of course, in those days, you know, it was like another species. You couldn't marry across that divide. But it showed me what I probably didn't need that to know, which is that she was a sexual and emotional being, as well as my mother's mother. Look, that thing about kind of anachronistic imposing of a 21st century woman, I mean, can we be that different? We can't really know. Literature is probably the best place to go. And you think of the novels written in the 19th century by women, they couldn't be very frank or they would never have got published. But, I mean, you think of the Brontes, for example, and between the lines of Jane Austen, isn't there seething passion? You know, these women were just like us. Mm. They fell in love, they felt sexual desire, probably not always for men, but, you know, they were not that different from us, is my feeling. And in subjecting them to the stereotype of the genteel kind of sexless image that we have of them, we're doing them a great disservice. We're kind of dehumanising them in a way. So because I'm not a historian, because I am in fact a novelist, I mean, I cheat in every possible way. I use the history when it pleases me, and I have been criticised for historians for doing this. I use it for the sake of a bigger story. Historians, I could not write my books without historians, I hasten to add. I'm intensely grateful and admiring. And I am like a magpie, just picking what's going to suit me. But as I said in the beginning, if you're not prepared to extend beyond what you know, then the danger is that the story will remain untold and unlistened to and unlearned from.
Mm-hmm. So let's go to that point of listening, because listening to you then reminded me of a session that I did here this afternoon about cross-cultural collaboration. Thomas Mayer was on the panel, Shannon Palmer, talking about the ways in which we form relationships as white and black Australians in particular that can lead us forward in relationships of connection and belonging. And the word that kept coming up and time again was listening. And the need to be able to drop into sometimes uncomfortable silences in order to hear what's really going on. We started talking about your book as having incredible orality, but it strikes me that you need to be able to listen to pick up the tones that inflect your work about the time, about the period. How do you listen to the archives so that you can actually infuse the work with such grand authenticity, even though it's fiction?
Gosh, that's a hard question, except that as I flick through the archive, there will always be a phrase that jumps out at me, and it's often like nothing, a nothing thing. But I have learned over the years to follow that. Mm. Do not stop and ask yourself, oh, you know, what's the point of that? That's not where I'm going. Mm. Just go with it, because it will reveal. Because I'm a great believer in writing out of the unconscious, to write out of what you don't know rather than what you do know. And what you say about listening, particularly across cultures, is interesting. You not only have to listen, but you have to listen with the awareness that you are probably not actually able to listen or not able to hear what is being said because of your own kind of cultural blinkers. So listening is not just a passive thing, it's also a surrender of your own kind of knowing of anything. So, look, the second book I wrote, Lillian's Story, started with a book. I was reading the letters of Jane Austen, and at one point she says, "In the nights we invent a few hard names for the stars." Now, it's a meaningless kind of sentence. Heaven knows what Jane Austen meant by it. But I was writing about a street lady, a bag lady, who had lived for a while in a park in Sydney. And I thought, that's her. In the night, we invent a few hard names for the stars. Suddenly, there's this whole scene in the park. She's lying there with a friend. They're looking up at the stars. So that's the kind of totally irrational, erratic, completely instinctive thing that I trust, probably more than anything else.
Mm. I think maybe historians could learn to write out of their subconsciouses more, perhaps.
Look, I think I would disagree with you there, because I think I certainly read history. I don't want that from a historian, actually. I would like nothing as simple as the facts, but I would like a picture that is actually not involving the historian, or if it involves the historian, be like Manning Clark, be absolutely frankly subjective. So, that's a whole other debate for historians to have.
Which we just had across the road in the session before this, which was about with Anna Clark, who, Professor Anna Clark, who's a friend of Kate's from way back as well, who was talking about the fact that there's a difference between the past and history. And the past is what happened, and history is what historians make of the past. Mm-hmm. And that all history is effectively selective and curated, and that comes out of, in a way, unconscious decisions that the historian's making about what's important, what's valuable, which speaks directly, in a sense, to what you were saying before, is that Dolly's story would not be written if you were working on objective criteria about what is significant in Australian history, for example.
Yeah, and that would be extremely valuable, because I've left out a whole lot of things. I'm still ignorant about a whole lot of things. That would be incredibly valuable. We need them all, I think, is what I would say. We need history, and we need novels, and we need the kind of weird hybrids that I tend to write. Mm.
That's a nice way of putting it. Kate, so much of the simple, quiet tragedy of Dolly's life is that she wanted more than she could ever have. All women's lives are constrained, you seem to say, but clever women had it much worse. That star that Dolly got from school, which came into the first passage, her bullying her daughter into a life that she wasn't ever had, the fact that she couldn't be a school teacher because of her father's dead body. Those were things that, in order to be a good girl, you couldn't be a clever girl. I'd like you to read this section.
I don't think she was too worried about being a good girl. She just wanted to do it. She didn't much care.
It's just a little bit there.
Okie doke. Okay, this is after the farm failed. She says to her husband, Bert, we've got to leave and we're going to go into business.
Bert Russell, that is, the smelly one.
Yeah, that's right. Who became her husband? My grandfather. So they started a little shop, tiny little grocery shop on the outskirts of Sydney. There was just one drawback to the shop, being with Bert all the time. At Rothsay, she'd had time to herself, Bert out in the paddocks or away for weeks at a time shearing. When he was away, it was as good as being a widow. Now he was never away. He was every day in the shop and every night in the bed that sagged in the middle, so no matter how you tried, you couldn't stop rolling into each other. As for what went on with her and Bert in the bed, well, it was never the radiant thing it had been with Jim. She thought you probably only got that once in your life, that mysterious coming together of who knows what, something that took two bodies and made them into one ecstatic, mindless, panting creature. For a teasing moment, she could sometimes get a flicker of that with Bert. She didn't mind it if she was in the mood, but Bert was always in the mood. Did I write that? I don't remember writing that.
So, tell us, Kate, this is clearly one of the ways. Then you go on to talk about how she actually in the city was able to discover such a thing as contraception and wasn't therefore constrained in the same way that many other women of her generation were by enormous families and just child after child. But tell us about the ways in which Dolly does feel trapped. And then I'm wondering whether Nance, your mother, enjoyed the freedom that Dolly so desperately wanted for herself. Did her program for progress work out?
Actually, it did, yes. Look, Dolly wanted to be a teacher. Clever girl, probably didn't want to get married, never particularly liked her children, except perhaps one. So in another world, or born now or 20 years ago, Dolly would be what we'd call a career woman, happy not to have children, perhaps not even to have a partner, might have been a member of parliament, might have been prime minister. So, you know, she was trapped because she couldn't get to first base, couldn't get the training as a teacher. The only thing for her, as a woman of that time, you could either be a teacher or a nurse, or if you were Catholic, you could be a nun. They were the only kind of paid employments, apart from being a laundry woman or a shopkeeper, I suppose. So she was barred from all of those, had to get married. She did marry the right guy, though. However, all the way through their marriage, even though she really ran the show, my grandfather was a very... anyway, that's another story. But it was his name on every lease. In every pub, they had a series of pubs around Australia. They would buy a pub, do it up, make a go of it, and then sell it a year
it's
later.
The restlessness.
The restlessness, for which Claire's book about women in hotels was extremely useful, I might say, part of my research. It was always Bert's name on the licence, Bert's name above the door, as every hotel has to have, and his name on the lease. So she had no freedom. She couldn't really leave. And in those days, a divorced woman was like anathema. And above all, she would have lost her children. And although she had kind of mixed feelings about children, she probably wouldn't have wanted to lose them entirely. The Anna Karenina kind of story. So she had all those limitations. And of course, no education and no proper training. So even when the world started to open up a bit, she had no real way of making a go of it. But she did. During the war, she had a whole series of jobs as a cook in a hospital, my mother told me. And her final job, my brother told me this, and I vaguely remember her coming back with bits of soap. The Australia Hotel was the grandest hotel in Sydney, and it had a ladies' toilet, of course. And the management needed to keep people from coming in off the street and using the facilities, so they hired somebody to be in charge of the bathroom. And that person, for a while, was Dolly Maunder. And my brother says, yeah, of course, she got the job because the man interviewing her took one look at her and said, ah, this battle axe will keep out the riffraff. So in her own way, and I think she loved that, it was, you know, in the ladies' toilet at the Australia Hotel, not much of a job, but she kind of, I remember her coming back with the little tiny cakes of soap that she sort of foraged from there. So she made what she could out of what was offered. But certainly my mother was the beneficiary of it. She became a very successful pharmacist, had several successful businesses, had several affairs, a very fulfilled, had just as many children as she wanted, three, and a reasonable husband. So, yeah. And here I am writing books. I mean, what could be better?
Kate, I'm aware that we've only got 5 minutes left. Yeah. Where's the time gone? And I should have said earlier, there's not going to be any questions in this session or the session to follow with Eve Rees and Alexis Wright, because we are having this special joint session. But the authors will be available to sign their books, and I'm sure we'll take your questions there. I want to end, Kate, by saying this session is called Voices of Australia. And that little word, voice, has become politically loaded and polarising even in the past year. Obviously, Australia's held a constitutional referendum on the issue of voice. I was really intrigued, and I must say, pleased, to find that your afterword is just as concerned with the silences of Australia as the voices of Australia. And I've got it marked here, but you're going straight to it.
Yeah, would you like, give me yours in case you've marked.
No, I haven't. You just read the whole lot. So I'd like you. I'd like.
It's not long.
Yeah. Can you just read that section, please?
Yeah. This is, in my mind, in a way, the most important part of this book, right at the end. And it's also, I suspect, where my future writing might be going. It's called Thinking About Silences. Dolly's great-grandfather, Solomon Wiseman, was a convict who took many acres of Darug land beside the River Dirrubbin, which we call the Hawkesbury. Her grandfather, John Martin Davis, was a free settler who took many acres of Gomeroi land beside the creek Carrabobla. Her father, Thomas Henry Maunder, was an indentured labourer who took many acres of Gomeroi land beside the mountain Warragundi. In their lifetimes, Dolly and Bert lived on country of the Gomeroi, Gurungai, Tharawal, Wiradjuri, Darug, Gwiagal, Gamaragal, Carrigal, Cumberwell and Gundungurra. Their ashes are interred on Woolloomedigal country. The lives of Dolly and her forebears all stand on the taking of land, but the family stories I drew on for this book are silent about that truth. They also record no awareness of the enduring sorrow that all that taking meant and means for First Nations people. As Dolly's granddaughter, I want to acknowledge that silence and that sorrow. I've told one story here, but standing beside it is another. Mm. And thank you, Claire, for giving me a chance to read that. It's important to me.
So the you know what? I'm not going to ask the question they had on the back of that because I think it stands alone. I think you've said everything that needs saying there. So I will just maybe, Kate, come back to, in a final question, the place that we started in terms of the idea of writing from the edges and your answer to the question of why you were so drawn to stories of women's lives who have lived on the edges is that you have always felt yourself to be one of those women. I'm wondering now, from this point of view, highly awarded, celebrated Australian writer, this book has just been, congratulations, shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Literary Awards in the fiction category. I wonder whether you still feel on the edge, or do you feel central now to Australian letters and culture?
Look, I think in a way the culture has shifted so that being on the edge is now kind of being in the middle, in a way. We're all prepared to accept and, in fact, to embrace the fact that we are all exploring our way into the future. None of us quite know either who we are or who we will become as a nation and as a culture. Thank goodness we live here now and not then is all I can think.
Well, thank goodness you live now with us, Kate, and you've been here with us this evening to share your generous words, your beautiful prose, your reflections on the writing process. And can I just urge you all to buy this book? It's as gorgeous as Kate has suggested in her readings tonight. And now that you've been in this session, you will hear her voice as you are reading the story. Thank you for being with us here tonight, Kate.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Kate and I are now going to do a baton change. We've watched our Olympians do it, and now we're going to watch our writers do this. Kate and I are going to swap seats with Alexis Wright and Eve Rees.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Act 2 of this two-part closing event for Bendigo Writers Festival. My name is Eve Rees, and I'm a senior lecturer in history at La Trobe University, and I'm really proud to be part of this La Trobe Presents closing gala for this year's festival. A big thanks to our guest curator, Claire Wright, just on stage a moment ago, La Trobe's Professor of Public Engagement, who's done an enormous amount of work putting together these sessions. So as well as a historian at La Trobe, I was also a judge for this year's Stella Prize. judging this prize was quite a daunting task, as I and the other four judges had to weigh up 227 entries across fiction, non-fiction, poetry, YA literature, and even graphic novels. But even though we spent 6 months kind of, you know, deep in the weeds of all these texts and deliberating and having kind of endless discussions back and forth, in the end, it was a really quite easy and obvious decision to find a winner. Because although it was a stellar year for Australian women and non-binary writing, there was one book that was simply in a league of its own. And that book was Praiseworthy by Alexis Wright, a novel that we judges called a canon-crushing Australian novel for the ages that is operatic in intensity as well as fierce and gloriously funny. So it's therefore my great pleasure to be speaking to the author of this novel, Alexis Wright herself, today. Alexis is a Wanyee author of fiction and non-fiction who's become, through this novel but many other books as well, internationally renowned as one of this country's greatest living writers. Among the many prizes and accolades she's received, Alexis's second novel, Carpentaria, won the 2007 Miles Franklin Award, and her collective memoir, Tracker, won the 2018 Stella Prize. Alexis is also the inaugural winner of the Creative Australia Prize, or Creative Australia Award, sorry, for Lifetime Achievement in Literature. Now, when this afternoon's event was organised, Alexis had already made history as the first person to win the Stella Prize twice. But in the last fortnight, she's done it again, when Praiseworthy became the first book to win both the Stella Prize and the Miles Franklin Award in 1 year. Alexis, welcome to Bendigo Writers Festival.
Thanks, James. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the Toronto... Judge Warang and Trung Warang people of the Kulin Nation, your elders past and present, and it's a pleasure to be on your traditional and sovereign lands today. Thank you.
Alexis, I know you're someone who, you know, is focused on the craft itself rather than reception too much. But I have to begin by asking, how does it feel to have won both the Stella Prize and the Miles Franklin Award?
Yeah, winning the Stella Award was quite incredible. We had an amazing event down in the State Library of Victoria. The Stella judges went up on the stage together, and it was this enormous event there, and it was fun, and it was incredible, and winning the Miles Franklin as well was I didn't think anything like that would happen, and well, it's incredible, and I'm really grateful and honoured, and really humbled by those prizes. And why wouldn't I be? This is incredible to think that these things can happen. I'm even stunned that I even wrote a book like this. I still am. I'm in awe of the book. So I'll leave it there with you, and I'll go. And speak for itself.
We'll just let the book speak for itself. So Praiseworthy is a novel set in the town of Praiseworthy, a fictional settlement in northern Australia that's being tormented by a methane-like haze that inhabits the skies above. Mm. And our protagonist is Causeman Steele, also known as Planet and Widespread, an Aboriginal man with a kind of slightly madcap vision to survive and thrive through the upcoming climate crisis by harnessing the power of donkeys. For anyone who hasn't read the novel, Alexis, could you give us a bit of an introduction to Praiseworthy and Coors Mansteel?
Look, I knew Praiseworthy would be a big dot novel in more ways than one. I was trying to capture the spirit of the times, you know, both here in this country and across the world. I asked myself big questions, and from big questions, many questions come out of that. And it was a lot of time in thinking about how to structure the novel aesthetically, and to capture the spirit of you know where we're at as people, you know, as where our humanity is sitting right now, and in terms of Aboriginal issues, in terms of climate change, the Anthropocene, and the fact that we can't seem to get to grips about what it's all about, and how threatened we are, the planet, thinking about how we think a lot about our own issues here, but it's becoming more and more apparent, just how interconnected we are, and interrelated in the Aboriginal world. We say we're related to all things, and so it was trying to structure a book that encapsulates all those things, and so Praiseworthy. Became a place. It's a fictional place, and there's a haze that settles over it. It's a haze made of pollution and mega fires, ash, and remains of billions, millions of animals and killed in these fires and country and. So it's a haze. It's an ancestral type haze as well. The ancestors are not happy with this. What's happening? So then you've got a character like Coors Mansteel. He's a culture dreamer. He's up to date with what's happening. Climate change. He's obsessed with it, and it's a fact that a lot of our communities are enduring longer and hotter summers, and there's concerns about we already have a lot of concerns about what's happening on our communities and what should be happening, and he's got a plan. He knows that no government in this country is going to help him or his people develop their own future, or a future that they are involved with, not what government policies involvement with, but what the communities might want to do themselves to develop their own future, and a future that they want to work towards. So he knows he's not going to get any help, and he knows that we need to be thinking about a future in terms of global warming. Things are getting hotter, and become almost impossible for some communities to be able to remain where they are the way things are going. And he wants to ensure that his culture and people are able to survive in the future, and how are they going to get across the burning planet, so to speak, to be able to tell the story, on the other side, just like his ancestors have done for tens of thousands of years. They've been through hard times before, and have managed to bring their culture into the future to what it is today. And he comes up with this great idea. You know, it all came to him in a dream, and it's just he remembers just a moment of this dream where it's in a dark night, and he sees catch the glimpse in the moonlight of this donkey, and it's not an ordinary donkey. It's a particular donkey. It's a particular shade of grey. Now, you know, you might think all donkeys are grey, but there's shades of grey, so he has this. This novel goes through the various shades of grey, you know, that you can find in donkeys to be, we actually have 5 million feral donkeys across northern Australia. And it's unbelievable. I haven't seen these 5 million donkeys, but they're there apparently. And what we tend to do is shoot them out of helicopters because they're a pest on pastoral properties, and so it seems, you know, so it's believed. And he's going to put these donkeys into good use. He's going to capture this particular donkey. It's a platinum grey. It's a particular power grey, you know, the power of warships, the power of rich people, you know, and it's or satellites or rocket ships and missiles, and this is the grey he's after. And so he knows that no one's going to help him with this. He's not going to get any government funding for it, for that's for sure. You know, to develop a future for his people, and that they might want to have. And some of his people don't even think they want this future either. But he wants to develop a transport conglomerate, an international transport conglomerate that will be made out of these donkeys. And in the time when we're not going to have any fossil fuel, you know, think about it. We may be hard up one day, all of us. And it's not going to be, you know, Aboriginal communities that are hard up, and or you know, the millions of people across the world, you know, who are refugees and are landless and stateless, and wars have been created to turf them off their country. There may be a time when we may be in great need. So he's thinking about that, and it might pay for a lot of people to think about it too, and that we might need to save the world one day, you know, and very soon. And his own brain power. That's a clapped out Falcon sedan. And he sets out on these mammoth journeys, these epical journeys, to try to capture this particular donkey that he glimpsed just momentarily in a dream. And so he sets out, and he undertakes many, many journeys, and they take ages because he really has to do it on a shoestring. To capture a donkey that he thinks is the right donkey, and so he's travelling over a very harsh country in northern Australia and all around the place, and to try to capture this particular donkey. And he does capture. He does feel, because he has seen it, you know, and amongst his feral donkeys that, you know, he finds, and he will capture. Can only take back one at a time in the back seat of the clapped out station. and these journeys take months. And he captures the donkey, you know, and manhandles it. He's got it, and he takes it back to Praiseworthy. And there's becoming quite a collection of these donkeys in Praiseworthy. That's another story altogether. And But by the time he gets it back into praiseworthy, and there's a haze, you know, this ochre colour haze there that sits permanently there. It won't go away. It's an oppressive haze. And you know, people do a lot of things there to try to get rid of this haze. And they've sent a butterfly to Canberra, you know, with a plead, will you come and take away this haze, you know, from praiseworthy. But, you know, politicians in Canberra shoot the butterfly and and it gets back there, its wings all broken and so forth. And Planet gets back with each donkey under the haze is when he sees it in under this particular light, it's never the platinum donkey that he's after. So he has to turn around and makes these journeys over and over again. And meanwhile, there's hundreds of donkeys that are stationed now in praiseworthy that are all the wrong shade of grey. And
the reject donkeys.
Reject donkeys, yes. And so it's a big story about that. It's a big story about his journeys, the difficulties and the difficulties he faces on those journeys, the difficulties he faces in praiseworthy, where people don't want these donkeys. You know, praiseworthy is on its way to becoming an assimilated place,
mm.
You know, and the people in charge, you know, are happy to take some money from Canberra. The scraps of what Canberra might offer, and they want to become us. They're on the road to become. They want all their people to become assimilated, and as soon as possible, and. They don't like these donkeys. They've made praiseworthy into a model town. It's a
tidy town, yeah. Hmm? A tidy town,
yes.
Yeah.
It's a prize tidy town. And so we have all these donkeys, you know, creating a mess around this place. And they invent a whole lot of bylaws about feral animals and... And that becomes very tricky about what is, you know, a feral animal and can certain feral animals, you know, be allowed to stay. And because you know, they've got poultry there, they've got ducks, and they've got pussycats and dogs and pigs and you name it. And so there's huge discussion is what's feral and what can stay and what can't stay, but definitely donkeys can't stay. And so it's a big story about all these things. It's there's hard issues that have talked about there, and but it is also in lots of ways a joy to write.
Yeah, well, Alexis, as you've really evoked in that introduction to the novel and its plot, This is an incredibly funny book, which I was not expecting. I was expecting, to find it epic and mesmerising and beautiful, but I don't think I was expecting this level of humour, which sort of prompted me to rethink my own assumptions about whether, serious literature can be funny or not. Mm. I'm interested in your thoughts about the role of humour in your work. You know, what do you see the humour as doing on these pages?
Well, I found it mesmerising and beautiful because it's meant to be mesmerising beautiful as well. And when you sit in a room for 10 years and write a book...
You gradually lose your mind.
No, you can lose your mind, or you can lighten up.
Yeah,
and you have to lighten up, otherwise you just about murder yourself.
Yeah,
and you get to that stage. It can all start very, very seriously, and eventually you have to make it work. And I see joy in the world, and like we all do, and I try to find the joy and in the big and the small. So, and it's also something I learned, and I see all the time, you know, in our communities as well, is people of great wisdom and great, you know, personal power. They seem to be able to carry the load, you know, that the burden that we that I know they carry and we carry every day, and but they carry it lots of times very lightly, and they can, you know, find that joy and laughter and fun of being alive, and you have to, and I learnt also from Italo Calvino, the greater Italian writer, in his last book, Six Memos for the Last Millennium, although he only managed to write five. One of those, lectures or essays that he wrote is on lightness, and he talks about in that the ability, he uses the ability of the shaman. On, you know, indigenous worlds, being able to carry that the weight, you know, that and their responsibilities lightly, and as you try to figure out a way to work out the future. And I think that's very true, and I see that, and I've worked and been amongst people who are of great humour and knowledge, and it's not that you're not taking the world seriously. You're taking the world very, very seriously, and all the time. I remember Patrick Dodson saying once that just not a day goes by where, you know, we've got. We haven't got something to contend with, and so I enjoy human. I enjoy being around people who are fun and enjoy the world, and so and these people who, you know, in the book, the characters in the book. In the book itself, there are, you know, very funny stories about the donkeys, you know, the world of the donkeys, and the eventual platinum donkey, which is a not very old donkey, doesn't see itself as being a masthead for the enormous, you know, international transport conglomeration, and would rather be back with its herd, you know, roaming. Feral around the bush, and he's trying to convince this donkey, to
take up its destiny.
To be brave, and do what you're supposed to do, you know, help carry the load, the donkey says, "Well, I don't really know if I really want to do all that." I think I'd just rather be left alone. Thank you very much, and no. Yeah, so he tells the donkey, stop being stupid, you know, this is what you've got to do.
Yeah. Well, as well as the humour about the donkeys, one of the other parts of the book I found hilarious is your depiction of social media. And I think this fascinated me because I think there are still relatively few contemporary novels that kind of accurately evoke the way the online world and particularly social media shapes our everyday life now. And I was really intrigued. I know you're not a sort of on social media yourself, no. Yet you have this incredibly accurate portrait of what I would call very online brain, the sort of slightly distorted mentality of people who kind of live on social media and become very quick to kind of anger and outrage as a result. And you present that very hilariously but also very darkly as well. How did you get to understand that mentality without being very online yourself?
It's all around you.
Yeah.
And, and the cancelling culture around a lot of young people I'm fascinated with what they say, look, what I'm trying to say as well, and you know, and I've seen it in certain political campaigns too. You know, I saw it during the intervention years. You know, the rollout of the intervention, and the criticism of Aboriginal people, the denigrating of Aboriginal men, and. One of the characters in the book is young Tommy Hawk, and he becomes addicted, really, you know, obsessed with what was being rolled out, and it screamed, you know, from the media and from politicians about, you know, Aboriginal men being, you know, violent and communities full of pedophiles and Aboriginal parents not loving their children, like white people love their children, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, that's just one aspect, you know, of that what the book is dealing with. But, you know, I also believe, you know, that we're a culture. You know, I take to heart, you know, what Will Self has said about reading big books, you know, that that we're prepared to, you know, go down to the gym and work our bodies out, you know, and be, you know, really harsh, you know, bang, 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 you know, just to keep fit and keep our bodies fit and well and everything. But we do little to give our brains a workout and you know, we take up whatever we know is, you know, from grabs, you know, from the media, from social media, and we're not looking at issues, you know, or concerns properly or in detail. And that also became very apparent, you know, through the intervention and also through referendum, so-called referendum, you know, on something that was so meaneless, and yet 60% of the population voted against it. You know, so it seemed to me that we know very little, and we need to read more and read well and read deeply. It's you know, we were a first class country, you know, first world country. Supposedly we have a first class education system, although, you know, one in three children, you know, across the country, you know, have very low, you know, a failing on their reading skills, their literacy skills, as well as maths, and we've got schools everywhere. We're supposed to send our children to school from the age of 4 or 5, you know, 5 to 16. That's compulsory. And we've got first-class universities. Why can't we read?
Yeah.
You know, and we must read. We're heading towards a really uncertain future. And we need to be able to understand, you know, a lot of the issues in the world to do with climate change, and to do with, you know, populations in the world, to figure out where we're going in the future. And we need to have a very close understanding of each other. And we can only do that if we're prepared to read and read well, and try to understand these big issues that are coming up for us. These unprecedented sort of events that take place, and the, you know, the consequences of you know, wars and you know, why are we doing these things? You know, why are we, you know, watching while, you know, thousands die, you know, in wars? So that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. Your answer then makes me wonder, I suppose, about bigger questions about you know, what art and particularly novels can do, or, you know, in times of crisis and collapse like we're living through now. Do you think, you know, novels serve to kind of document these moments, or can we change these moments through writing novels as well?
I think we can only try, you know.
Yeah.
Literature is a good way to understand issues and, you know, understand people, and I think literature needs to be working outside of our own yard, you know, and embracing, you know, not just ourselves, you know, as, you know, humanity or human beings, but the total of the world that we live in, you know, the non-human beings that have a right to be here as well, and what you see all around you, you know, in any country, it has as much right to be here as you have, and that's, we've got to learn to understand those things a lot better, you know, as we try to fathom, you know, where we go in the future and what young people are, you know, coming up into that world, you know, how they deal with it. And we're not just going to get it from social media. We're not going to get it from the media. I tell you. You know.
Well, Twitter isn't going to save us.
And if the world, you know, if it becomes a problem, you know, that there's more and more people in the world that are, you know, are doing really, really badly, it's going to make a very unsafe world. And so I think literature is a good way to try to develop some understanding and compassion and empathy for each other, and we get past this idea of, you know, it's all right for us, even though they're suffering over there, or it's all right for them to die, you know, for us to live. And I really just think literature is very important. Or you could read, the thinker and philosopher and man of a high intellect, Achille Mbembe, you know, from Cameroon, and he talks about necropolitics, you know, about those sort of, you know, who lives and who dies, and I just finished reading his the Earthly Community. It's only about 100 pages. But I tell you what, it takes more deeper reading than this book, and because he talks about how the world as a whole has been positioned and been pulled, and we're going along with it, and it's a really important piece of work, a really important work that he does. He just won a major prize in Norway for thinkers of, you know, world. It's a very important prize. It's something like, I think it's $1 million, I think.
Oh.
Yeah. And so he can devote time to that sort of research that he's doing. It's very important.
Yeah. Alexis, your work is often associated with the category of Australian literature. The New York Times called praiseworthy the most ambitious and accomplished Australian novel of this century. We're at a session today called Voices of Australia, and you've held the Beauvoir Chair in Australian Literature at University of Melbourne. Yet you also belong to a nation and a culture that predates Australia by tens of thousands of years. I'm interested to hear how you see yourself and your work into this, in relation to this category of Australian literature. does it resonate for you, or does it feel not like your kind of cultural home?
I don't really think about it.
Yeah.
No, that's not something that I would think I feel I need to think about.
Yeah.
And I feel that all I do is well, these days all I do is write. All I do is talk about writing. And I made a decision a long ago when I first started writing that no one would tell me how I was going to write in this country, and I needed to figure it out in my own way to do what I wanted to do. And I read widely across the world, and to try to understand how to write and to come to this stage of writing a book like Praiseworthy. And I already had, a good education, from my own people, and starting with my grandmother from a very early age. I think my consciousness was formed by a wonderful grandmother who looked after me when I was a very small child. Well, I decided that she was the one who's going to look after me, and every time my mother turned her back, I just jumped the front fence and go down to her place to be with her, and nothing was ever said. And it's in our culture as well that you look after each other and children, and the people that I've worked with in my life. I've worked with some really fine senior people of great knowledge and wisdom, and some of the best political minds in the country, in our world. So, but I needed to figure out how to do that sort of writing, and I didn't want anyone to, even though it probably, and it could have well meant I never got published, but in the end, but I didn't want anyone to tell me how to write an Australian novel.
Mm.
Or what an Australian novel was, and to be restricted and put it in that box, or told to be, I'm an Aboriginal writer, I must write in this particular way. And I was asked to write in some particular way by our own people. And I do honour some things there. I would listen, but I wasn't going to be told by the publishing industry how I was going to write, or what that expectation, and if you were going to be published or not. And very nearly didn't get published. And I have a good publisher who I've been with for 20 years now, and it's a good relationship. Yeah.
Yeah, that publisher is obviously Giramondo. I've heard you say at the Stella Award night and on several other occasions that you think Ivor Indic, who's the publisher there, is the best publisher in the world, which is a big call. I'm curious to know what you think makes Ivor and Giramondo such a good publisher.
Well, when I had the manuscript for Carpentaria, and that was really written in the way you started to feel that this is the direction I want to go in, and I was taking a lot of risks with that novel, and in voice, style, your content, characters. And it was rejected by practically all publishers in Australia, that novel. Ivor was just starting to set up his publishing industry, his publishing company, and he was only publishing a few books a year. And a good friend who's a writer, he said, send it to Ivor, let him have a look at it. I was still in Alice Springs then, and I sent the manuscript to Ivor, And he sent back an email to me with a number of questions, which were all mounted to, why did you write this novel like this? And so I answered it the best I could and sent the email back. And I really expected I wouldn't hear from Ivor again, because he had to make hard choices about what he publishes. And he came back straight away and said, I'll publish it. And we had a good working relationship. He didn't want to turn the novel upside down. He didn't want to do an English high school teacher type edit on the work, and to make it into something else. If he had done that, and someone did try to do that, and I rejected that, but he didn't, because if he had, it would have taken away what that book is.
Yeah.
And that's the way we've worked. And I trust his judgment. Sometimes we argue about it. He's a very argumentative person sometimes. And so am I. But we get on really well. And he's careful for praiseworthy was just extraordinary. He loved it right from the start, because he thought, well, perhaps he had to wait a long time to get this book, because I was working on Tracker and then the Barbovia position, and just snatching times to write, and really needed to keep rewriting. And so I was taking my time with it, but I think it's good to take time. It gives you more time to think about what you're actually doing, and that's a good thing, I think. And but when he read the manuscript, he just said all these just amazing things about it. It was just he can be hard, but he wasn't with that. He wasn't with praiseworthy. It was amazing. I couldn't believe it.
Unfortunately, Alexis, we're almost at the end of our time together, but one final question to ask. I know you're a writer who loves to challenge yourself, so I need to ask, how are you challenging yourself next after Praiseworthy?
That's a good question. I should have been a long way ahead with that challenge because there's a new novel coming, but I'll get back to it very soon. And this has been 2 years of fairly constant work with Praiseworthy, and it's been good. I can't complain. But I'll get back to the new novel, and it'll be good. I'm really keen to start. I had a dream just recently, and I keep notebooks, and so there's a lot of notes for this new novel. And I had a dream, and it was an amazing dream. It was an incredible dream that I've never had that sort of dream before, and it's given me the way this that's how it's going to start. And I'm not going to tell you, but
leave us hanging.
it's good. And believe me, it'll be good.
Okay.
I'm also doing another book with one of my Gungalita countrymen in Carpentaria, Gulf of Carpentaria, Marindu Yena. So we've done some recordings together, so I go up there in the next at the end of the month, and we'll continue doing recordings. And he's just got a brilliant, remarkable mind, and he's amazing. Well, most people in the Gulf of Carpentaria are amazing anyway, and top notch. So his book will be terrific.
Yeah. Well and truly whetted our appetites for those new books. This brings us to the end of our closing gala for the Bendigo Writers Festival and the whole festival for 2024. Thank you all so much for being part of it, and I hope you have a safe journey back to wherever you call home. Please join me in thanking Alexis Wright for her time this afternoon.
You've been listening to Literary La Trobe, a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri country. To find out more, visit the La Trobe University website.